Hello, friends. Patrick McFarlane here of the Liberty Weekly podcast, coming at you with another episode. This one is episode number 150, and the show notes may be found at libertyweekly.net/150. And I'm very glad to be joined by Drew of the Clean Libertarian podcast. Welcome to the show, Drew. How's it going?
It's going very good. Thanks for having me on, Pat. I've been looking forward to this.
Yeah, man. And thanks for reaching out to me on Twitter. I think we had a bit of an exchange, but so do you want to tell the listeners just a little bit about your work? I understand that you've been a listener of mine for a while.
Yes. This is a very surreal experience for me, because when I first learned about libertarianism, I didn't know what else to do besides kind of like look for podcasts, and Liberty Weekly was the first one that popped up, and I started listening to both you and Keith, and you know, you guys talked about like Dave Smith and Pete Quiones, and you know, you introduced me through your podcast to a lot of furthering my own understanding, as well as the content that both the two of y'all created. So that's pretty awesome being here, man. But basically I run the Clean Libertarian podcast, and what it is a podcast that seeks to expand the conversation on ending the war on drugs with the added nuance of somebody who is in recovery. So rather than have the stereotype of the hedonistic libertarian, you know, screaming, you know, legalize recreational cocaine, like maybe there's some value in discussing this from a standpoint of a teetotaler. So that's kind of the idea, you know, that's the whole shtick there. And I think we're getting there. We're trying to fit into it. But like I was talking to you, Pat, it's kind of like I painted myself in a corner a little bit with it, but we'll be okay.
Well, I thought so, you know, first of all, it's super awesome to be talking to you, and I'm really glad to hear that. You know, when you do a podcast, and I'm sure you're learning this, is that you really just sit there and you talk into a screen. You don't get to see people listening on the other side. And sometimes you do in a situation like this, but to know that you've been able to, you know, change or affect the way that someone sees libertarianism or politics, super cool. And even the fact that you started your own podcast now is like, I've always said that everyone needs to have their own show. Like I really don't think, you know, there's no such thing as too many libertarian content producers.
Absolutely not, man. Glad to join the ranks.
Yeah. Have you liked it so far?
It's been touch and go. I've enjoyed it. Sometimes it feels kind of like, what am I doing? You know, but then there's some episodes that I do that I'm like, man, this is great. You know, like this is what I had in mind. So I think, you know, I'm on episode 32. I'm recording 33 tonight. So I'm still kind of in the beginning stages somewhat. So, I mean, when I first started out, dude, I was using a phone, right? I was using Podbean on my phone and like sitting in my car. And then now I've got this like headphones and little microphone and stuff like that. So the sound quality's actually come up a little bit, and I'm having fun with it in that regard. So long way around the barn of saying, yeah.
Well, good. I mean, that's what it's all about. You know, it's like you don't want to spend a whole bunch of time doing something in your free time that you don't enjoy. And it's like, you know, you got it. If you're not enjoying it, people can tell too.
Right. Right.
So, yeah, I always thought I painted myself in a corner with the whole like law, like being so law focused. So I'm glad the name that I chose is very facially, you know, not specific. Yeah,
you're wide open, man.
Yeah.
Liberty Weekly. Yeah. You can do whatever you want with that.
I still remember the moment. Sorry, I don't mean to hog the spotlight or any. I remember the moment that I thought of the name. I was like, too. Little did I know I'd still be dealing with it 5 years later, you know, or whatever. But so why don't you tell me a little bit, like, so how did you find Liberty? What's your Liberty journey?
So I am from the old Bernie Sanders camp, if you can believe it or not. Like, I never was on board with the free stuff for everybody, you know, mantra. I was more on board with this dude is talking about ending the wars. Cause like, you know, I told you I'm in, you know, recovery and all of that. So for the bulk of my life, I was too busy, you know, partying to even pay attention to politics. So when I started to somewhat pay attention. You know, I was clean. Bernie Sanders was around and he was starting to talk. And I'm like, this guy seems genuine. And so, you know, I started following along and paying attention to that. And I was rooting for him. And then on national television, I mean, this is after the WikiLeaks and everything came out showing what happened in the DNC. I watched that man kneel down and kiss the ring on national television. And it was just like, that was it for me. I was like, dude, this is BS. You know, like, that's not what I'm about at all. Like, this dude's a fraud. I felt betrayed. And a buddy of mine had told me about Gary Johnson. And Gary Johnson and LP National, they never really intrigued me a whole lot. I was like, oh, he sounds cool. He's never going to win. You know what I mean? But like, at least it's an option. But that was the first time that I heard the word libertarian outside of the show Parks and Rec, right? Like, never was exposed to it. You know, when Ron Paul's heyday was going on, like I said, I wasn't around. And so I started looking into libertarianism and trying to figure out what the hell that meant. I think I joined Liberty Memes on Facebook, started, you know, like getting exposed to all the dank memes over there. As far as podcasts went, like I said, I found you. You guys were great. Y'all turned me on to Free Man Beyond the Wall. That was like, you want to talk about like red pill to like massive red pill. Like, it was just insane how that happened for me. But, you know, it's just like little by little, I started learning. And then I kind of got involved in the political process because I'm a felon. I have a drug charge. As a result, I'm unable to own a firearm legally, right? So my whole big thing was like, how can I help other people who are in the position that I am while also helping myself? And so currently from where I'm sitting, seems like the only thing that would have a shot at that is political pressure. And the Oklahoma Libertarian Party just so happened to be very accepting and accommodating to letting me sit down and talk with them. And so I started coming around and hanging out. And before I knew it, like, you know, you get railroaded into these positions. And so like, all of a sudden I'm creating a county affiliate for the LP and like, I'm doing this and doing that. And so that kind of brings us to where we are today, man. Politically, for what it's worth, I think that the Libertarian Party has a shot at changing policy in my backyard. And so that's what I put a lot of my effort into. And then as far as on a national level, like I just hope to see the conversation change and for people to stop saying that libertarians are Republicans who want to smoke weed. Cause I don't want to smoke weed. I've been clean for a while now, you know, like I just want to do my thing. And I think that we're changing some of the stereotypes there at least. So, but yeah, I don't know if that answers your question or not, but that's kind of where we're at.
Well, yeah. I mean, what a unique perspective that you have. I'm thinking of people like Mike Tilden, a friend of the show. I don't know if you know Mike, but he's a former police officer who became a libertarian and realized that he hated being a police officer.
Awesome.
Rafer Davis, another one like that. He was a police officer that became a voluntarist. But how good is the perspective that you have on the drug war and how, you know, I was hoping you could shed some light on this in this episode, but seeing firsthand the perverse incentives of criminalization and what that does for addicts maybe trying to get clean or how it would affect that to begin with. I mean, you have the firsthand experience, so.
Yeah, and I've been kind of going on and off on a Twitter rant all day long. So I'm going to take it back to the 1950s mm-hmm. before you and I were even around, okay? And actually, this was the 1970s, give or take. But in New York, they had these laws called the Rockefeller Laws. And it was essentially a tough on crime stance towards drug addiction, where it's like, you get busted for anything, like you're going to prison for life, like no shot whatsoever. Well, some of the language in these laws made it to where two addicts couldn't occupy this same place at the same time. So a 12-step recovery meeting was effectively outlawed by the state.
Wow.
Right? Insane. And there's this guy, his name is Father Dan Egan. And at the time, it was like way taboo. You don't talk to drug addicts. You don't try to help them. The going phrase at the time was once an addict, always an addict. And that's just the way it was. There was no detoxes. There was no hospital wards for addicts. Like it's just they're lock them up or just shoot them in the head because there was no hope. Well, Father Dan Egan had upstanding. I don't know a lot about the Catholic Church. I just know that like he was either a priest or something, or, you know, he'd worked his way up the ladder. Sorry if there's any Catholic listeners. Like, I'm not trying to be blasphemous.
Mike Tilden is a Catholic.
No, I'm sorry, Mike. Forgive me. But he'd worked his way up, and he started trying to help junkies in his area. And he actually talked about how he met this, she was a prostitute junkie on the subway. And she was like, Father, help me. You know, like I've got all these problems. He's like, meet me at the hospital. You know, I'll get you right in the room or get you into a room. We'll get you fixed up. And to his surprise, there was no help that was offered at that time. And so not only was the medical system not willing to help, but also the government solution is lock them up. So he's seeing a certain number of his, what he, you know, cause he viewed these people as parts of his congregation or his flock, you know, like he cared about people. And, so he took this personally and he made it his life mission to help people out. And he lost his standing. He got booted out of his convent. I guess that's what they call it, church or whatever. And like they named him the junkie priest. And at the time it was an insult. Well, you know, fast forward some years and he's still going by the junkie priest, but now it's a mark of honor for him. Like he's helped people out. There's a story about in a particular area of New York City, he went to the stores in the area and he said, now, listen, you guys come together and you help me fund a halfway house. And I promise you, I will send the girls to shoplift downtown instead of uptown. Right. That was his selling point. And the funny thing is that they did it. And as promised,
it worked.
The shoplifting, it trended downwards. So wow. It takes people who haven't actually been there to fight the state on our behalf, because as an addict, me personally, as I am, like, it's just like anything else, man. If you have a tainted background, like your word doesn't carry at all with politicians, you know, never mind you all the blood that's on their hands, you know, whatever you did, just being a drug addict, you know, your word doesn't count for anything. So, you know, on the spiritual level, we had like, you know, Father Dan Egan. On the political level, we had like the Ron Paul, like that. I've seen that clip floating around today of him on that. Have you seen that clip of him on the talk show? Like way back in the 70s,
the one where he gets really mad.
Yeah, he's pissed.
Yeah, like
and rightfully so, because yeah, they're talking trash, you know.
Yeah.
But so that's kind of how it's been, and where we're at today, we're a lot further along. Like we have detoxes for addicts, thank God, because of, you know, where we've been. There's now comprehensive rehabilitation programs and things along those lines. However, we are still making addicts carry the scarlet letter of felon for the remainder of their lives, mm-hmm, because of what boils down to a mental health issue. You know, it's not a moral failing on the individual. As someone who's in recovery, I go to meetings a lot, right? So I spend a lot of time talking to newcomers that come in the rooms, and it's not just your stereotypical, you know, junkie, you know, coming in with track marks. Like it's the soccer moms, and maybe they sprained their ankle and the doctor hooked them up with some pills and like, they don't know how to stop. Like they're freaked out and they don't know how it happened, how they wound up to where they are. And so for me, it's kind of like an indicator that there is these markers present in people long before the drug ever gets introduced to their body, that makes them predisposed to being addicted to drugs or not, you know, because some people are able to quit, you know, they're able to find that willpower or whatever you call it. And then some people just absolutely cannot. And so that's kind of like my diagnosis of the situation. Here's how the state has been handling it. So the state, if you get arrested for drugs here in Oklahoma, what they're going to do is, you know, they'll let you out pretty quickly, but you're going to have to show up for court. Now at court, they're going to do one of two things. One, they're going to send you to prison, or they're going to put you in drug court. We all know prison, and that's just time behind bars, but drug court is like super strict probation, meaning you call this number every day of the week, and they have a color code. And let's just say your color's red. Well, they'll say red, blue, whatever, and you got to drop whatever you're doing, find a way downtown, go take a drug test, and pay for it yourself. This could be five times a week, could only be once, but that's like $40 a pop. So not only do you have to do that, you also have to go to all these classes that they set you up with, and then you have to pay for counseling. And at the cherry on top is that they send you to these 12-step nonprofit recovery programs. So essentially, the state is saying, we don't have a solution besides sending you to a nonprofit, but what we can do is make a little money off of you. And that's what they're doing, man. They're turning these people into cash cows. And that's kind of the bitch of it, man. That's kind of the, I'm sorry. I don't know if you cuss or not.
No, it's okay. No, no.
Okay. Okay. That's kind of the problem with it is that, you know, we've been going down this road for so long. We've marked so many people as felons. I can't even, okay. So for me, I can't own a firearm. I never went to prison. So the longest I spent was 4 months in county. I spent 8 years after leaving county, not being able to vote on what my tax dollars were going to be used for. Right. Mm-hmm. So taxation without representation right there. And we can argue all day about whether or not voting matters, but
right. Yeah.
That's not morally acceptable. Right. Like I didn't harm anybody. I didn't take anybody's stuff. Like literally I got in trouble for buying pills from a pharmacy without the proper credentials. That was my charge. And so I've been passed up for promotions. I can't even volunteer at my daughter's school. You know, I mean, dude,
yeah.
You know, like what incentive does that give people? Now, thank God that I found the group of people that I did, and the rooms of recovery who had been there and done that and show me a way out. But dude, there's a lot of people that don't find that and they keep going back. The recidivism rate is through the roof, you know, and I can't blame them, man. You know, because you're kneecapping people's ability to make a good life for themselves, you know? So that's kind of my shtick. And I know I was all over the place, man, but like this, I get real mad. I get big mad this one topic.
No, I would, I have experience, you know, I practiced criminal law for maybe a year and a half and I did some public defender work. I've had some experience with the drug court and it's, honestly, like drug court is heralded as this like great progressive solution. But I mean, at the very least, you could at least have not put the added financial burden on participants to take UAs, exactly. You know, all the time and pay for counseling. I know it's different in some counties or different states or what have you, but it really is heralded as like this progressive solution. Some kind of an adaptive treatment thing, treatment court. Yeah.
And that's just like government, right? To come up with a solution and then just break their arms, patting themselves on the back
right.
for it. You know, like, oh, we're doing so good here. It's like, no, you're not.
I mean, shouldn't they know that addicts, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but addicts who do not want to go to treatment usually don't do well if they're forced to be in treatment.
100%.
Yeah.
No. And here's the thing is that like a lot of people, maybe when they got busted, they weren't at the extent that their addiction was going to take them. So it's kind of like, you know, for a lot of us, when we buy that ticket, we take that ride and we don't necessarily get to say, okay, I'm done. Like it's gonna stop when it stops, and usually it's not good. And a lot of people get busted when they're so new into their addiction that they still have the wherewithal to be able to skate through these programs and, you know, tread water. And when they get on the other side of it, the problem is that since there was no actual recovery that was taking place, they oftentimes jump right back in where they left off. And if you're an opiate addict, you know, or other kind of hard drugs, that's not a safe thing. That's not a safe thing at all. And so, you know, you're thinking that you have your tolerance still from way back when you don't, you know, and I've seen that happen a lot, man. I've seen a lot of people who successfully completed drug court, and then within a matter of months, they're dead, you know?
Yeah. And I, so that's rough, man. And so is it true what I would rhetorically say about, the economics of drug addiction is that, like, is it that people are committing crimes when they're on drugs because they're trying to make money to buy more drugs?
Here's my take on it is that that's not always the case. It is for some. I'd be lying. I mean, you know, I think addicts pretty much have the property crime demographic nailed down pretty good.
Yeah.
That, if nothing else, we're pretty good at that. But I don't think that just somebody who wasn't already open to doing something like that was just going to all of a sudden start doing it. You know, I think that, like I said, there's markers for, you know, drug addiction that were present long before the drug was introduced. I think that goes along with the other part of it too. You know, I did things I wasn't proud of, but far and wide, like, I did things to other bad people, right? Like, yeah. I robbed other bad people, and it was just all of us robbing each other constantly, you know. But there's a lot of people who maybe didn't have that kind of line, you know, and they were kicking in like good people's doors and like stealing their stuff. And so I don't know, man, I kind of come and go on that topic. I did a write up a while back about, you know, debunking the myths surrounding ending the war on drugs. And that's kind of one of those questions that, cause I asked a lot of friends of mine who aren't libertarian, who just are, you know, normal people. And I asked them, like, you know, what are your big, what's your biggest apprehensions regarding ending every law known, you know, in terms of narcotics? And that was one of those that got brought up. And so it kind of hinges on the idea that if we did legalize all drugs or decriminalize either route that you wanted to go, the idea that all of a sudden there's going to be just millions of people going out and trying black tar heroin overnight. And I don't know, man, I don't see that happening. Maybe I'm wrong, but, you know, I don't see my 60-year-old neighbor, you know, going out trying to get some heroin. You know what I mean? Like, I think that people are going to be a little bit more reserved than that. So I don't know if that answers your question or not.
In regards to that, yeah. Do you buy the argument, this libertarian argument that I've made a lot, is that, well, if drugs were cheaper, then people wouldn't have to ruin their lives spending all their money buying drugs. They could just spend a small amount of their money on drugs and get what they need to do, to stay, you know, keep from getting withdrawals or anything like that. And they would, you know, still have the money to keep their life in some semblance of order.
I think that if you're able to do that, you're not an addict.
Okay.
And that's, and that's going to be real honest. And the last thing I wanted to do was come on your show and refute you. That's definitely not.
No, I want you to. At all. I want you to.
Okay. Well, I would have to take the negative on that assertion.
Yeah.
Only because, so like for me, and this is going to sound a little risque, but if I chose to go out and relapse tonight, right? So relapse is like having sex with a gorilla. It's not over until the gorilla says so.
Yeah.
And that's funny, but I mean, that's the truth.
Yeah.
Somebody like me I have one choice and one choice only. That is to use or not to use. The problem is that when I use, that second time isn't a choice anymore. And it doesn't stop until it stops. And nobody knows what that looks like. I can't moderate. I can't try to, you know, wean myself off. There is none of that. Like it does. Moderation is not a word that is in my vocabulary. I mean, do you see my little chins I got here, dude? Like if it's food, you know what I mean? Or it's gambling or it's this or that. Like I struggle with, you know, moderation. Now the other side of that is that the likelihood in a scenario like you laid out, you know, maybe if people were able to purchase drugs, knowing the exact milligram when they started out, knowing the exact potency, knowing the exact side effects to the T, maybe see less people go down the road that I went, right? Because the thing is that, you know, the only understanding that I had before I got like deep into drugs was what DARE showed us, right? And DARE's putting weed on the same level as heroin. And it's just, dude, that is asinine. It's crazy, you know, and it, that's not the case. But I don't know, man. I think that there's a good chance that maybe we could see at the very least harm reduction. Okay. So you wouldn't see as many overdoses and things like that. But I don't know, man, that addiction thing, it grabs some of us in such a way that even trying to moderate it ourselves and just go a little bit at a time, it won't work.
Mm-hmm. Well, so when you argue to people that, I mean, I assume that you alluded to it, but I assume you take the position that we should legalize or decriminalize everything.
Yes.
Okay. Well, when you take that position, what are the main arguments that you lead with?
I lead with fentanyl. Currently, mm-hmm. fentanyl. So instead of addicts making their way to the meeting that I'm sitting at in a given night, there's a good chance that addict's going to be winding up in a casket because they were lied to about what was in their, you know, cocktail that they had that evening. Fentanyl exists in drugs because it's a cheaper filler and it greatly enhances the potency, especially in opiates. Now, here in Oklahoma, what we've been seeing happen is that they're actually starting to put fentanyl in methamphetamines as well. And it's all to kind of like keep people addicted, keep people coming back. I mean, everything's Hollywooded up, you know, all the shows like Narcos and things like that. But there's some symbol of truth to that, to where like it's territorial. Like you're only going to be able to find black tar heroin in Oklahoma City unless you find a one-off from somebody who went to New York and brought some, you know, white, you know, China back. But and the same thing with meth. You know, it's a very specific type that comes from Mexico, and it's real weird, man. So you have this flood of unknown substances on the streets. So that is what the drug war has brought us. So the first thing that we have to do when we're talking about shifting our perception as a society and as policymakers into a more lenient society is to shatter this illusion that somehow if we legalize drugs, that there's just going to be like those 50-gallon drums, you know, bonfires in the middle of the street, used needles littered everywhere, and instead try to paint the picture of a CVS pharmacy where somebody can walk in and make an informed decision on what exactly they're going to be ingesting, you know, and that's kind of that way that I'm leading it in. And as we see more of these, like safe injection sites pop up, they're unsightly. It's a hard thing to talk about, but you know, the longer that this whole war on drugs goes on, especially when we're right on the heels of the opioid epidemic, quote unquote, there's a lot of people that at least know somebody who was wrapped up in that or has struggled with addiction. So whereas maybe 20 years ago, trying to have that conversation, we would be feeling like Ron Paul did on that talk show, we're actually being met with somewhat reasonable dialogue, you know, going back and forth. And so I'm hopeful, man. And hell, you know, in 2020, we saw Oregon decriminalized. Like, dude, that's a huge, huge win. It's a big thing. Now, what's that going to look like for them? You know, yeah. Like, got to wait and see.
Well, or the thing that concerns me about Oregon specifically is what other progressive policies are taking place that are going to sour the results. You know, it's not something that's an experiment taking place in a vacuum. It's taking place with a whole bunch of other policies that could not help.
Yeah.
Stand in
and
the
I
way.
Actually had I had Matt Sutton on. He's with Drug Policy Alliance. I always screw that name up. I can't remember, but he was actually on the ground floor when that legislation was drafted and written and everything. And so he was, you know, that was his baby, and he kind of explained it, and there's some good things to it. So instead of it being a, you know, ride to jail, you have an option. You can either pay the fine, which is like $150, or you can forego the fine and go get a medical detox assessment. So, and therein lies the problem for me. Mm-hmm. Like, I care probably more than anybody else that, you know, you'll come across about the struggling addicts. I do not agree with forcing somebody else to pay for our recovery.
Yeah.
And that's essentially what that is. You know, when you force somebody else to pay, that doesn't put a good taste in the mouth of, you know, somebody who's, I mean, I've just been a Bud Light guy my whole life, and that's all I've ever done. I've never even smoked a joint. Like, that guy's not going to understand, you know, the value in getting the junkie across town some help. So, yeah, I'm with you, man. I think that's one part of that legislation that I really wish they would have left out of it, but it's Oregon. What are you going to do?
Yeah, and I can't pretend that I'm very informed about exactly the contents of the bill either. So as just a generalization on my part, just assuming that there's something in Oregon that's going to ruin it, you know?
Yeah. it's pretty much a guarantee anymore, isn't it?
Yeah, it really seems like it. So what would you say are some state policies that would you say that there's a lot of side effects of say that there's a lot of aspects of the war on drugs that actually creates new addicts?
Yeah, 100%. Like I said, so as it stands for the new drug user, your information is coming from the drug dealer. The chances that you are going to get an honest appraisal on what it is you're about to ingest is slim to none. You know, chances are you're at a party, somebody hands you this thing and blah, blah, blah. It's like, so it's a cloud of mystery kind of going on already, you know? And so as a result, you got people that are just trying stuff to try it. You know, if you're into the party scene, you're partying. If you're not, cool, whatever. But so there's already no real honesty or accountability going on. And I mean accountability in the sense that, like, you sell me something wrong. If I go to Little Caesar's Pizza and they spike that pizza with fentanyl, you best believe I got an avenue. I can have my day in court. But if I do that with the drug dealer across town, you know, I go complain, they're going to throw me in jail for buying drugs, right? You know, like, and then he's going to keep selling, you know? So already you're creating this system to where addicts are only accountable to themselves. Now, the crux of it is that addicts helping each other is actually how recovery works. But addicts in active addiction relying on each other, it's the blind leading the blind. You know, it's not a good place. The market can't operate in its purest form in that environment, because it's kept in the back alleys. It can't be brought out into the light. And so just that aspect alone, you create a lot of consumers making ill-informed decisions, and that's never going to have a good result. Never. So that's one aspect of it. And then the other is, like I said, so, you know, we've seen a rise in fentanyl across the country. if you survive, you know, assuming that it didn't overdose and kill you, like, dude, fentanyl is potent. And if you survive, you're going to want more of that. And it's just, I mean, dude, it's really getting scary out there. So the addictive qualities already of heroin are there, but you know, you add in this whole fentanyl mess and it's a monster, man. So yeah.
From your perspective, have things, because I mean, we've heard for years and years and years people saying, oh, it's getting bad, it's getting bad, it's getting bad. Are we on a trajectory where things just keep getting bad, or is it, you know what I mean, is it kind of flowy? Or
I think the worst elements of it currently, like we are getting better. Like we as a society are getting better. If the government could just get out of the way, it'll get a lot better. But so long as we have these policies in place that we're sending people to jail and keeping them in a position to where the, you know, like I said, you got the scarlet letter of felon. All you've ever known is that party lifestyle. Well, you get out and try to get a good job, find out that's not going to work because now you have a drug charge on your record. Dude, it takes a very specific type of mentality to make it out of that, right? So I think what we see now is with the rise in felons that's occurred over the past 20 years, I think that you are starting to see more employers that are becoming more lenient on what they require as far as background checks go, but not for the positions that, you know, a lot of people want to get. Like, you know, I would like to sit at a desk all day.
Yeah.
That ain't going to happen. That ain't going to happen with my background. Like, I got to do what I got to do. But so it's kind of hard to say. I will say that like the market solution has been, you know, nonprofit 12-step programs. You see a lot of non-12-step specific programs popping up. There's a lot of spiritual solutions happening. Right now, an addict who is walking into trying to find a better way to live has more information at their fingertips than ever before in the entirety of human history. So in that aspect, they got a lot going for them. But, you know, it goes back to getting the government out of the way.
Yeah. Yeah. And I totally blanked on what I was going to ask you next. I'm sorry.
You're good.
Yeah.
But like, that's kind of like that part, you know, see, what is that guy? He was in, Forgetting Sarah Marshall.
Yeah.
Who's that British comedian guy?
Yeah. What's his name? Russell Brand.
Russell Brand.
Yeah.
Russell Brand is a perfect example of the market doing its thing. And he has kind of adopted the 12-step programs and kind of made his own type of thing. And he's worked wonders for people across the board.
Really? I didn't know that.
Yeah. Yeah. That dude is awesome. Like he really has a lot of unique perspective on recovery and whatnot. You see trendiness on recovery coming up, like sober is sexy and all this, that, and the other. It's now something that isn't taboo to talk about anymore. Now it's something that we can have an honest and open dialogue about it. And so that's the beautiful part. Now here's the other part of it too, is that there's also treatments that are starting to pop up. Ayahuasca, Ibogaine. There's a couple others and my mind is blanking on. Well,
but I was going to ask you what you thought about psilocybin, like microdosing or treating addiction with psilocybin.
I think that I don't know enough because there hadn't been enough opportunity for people to have an honest study on it, but I think that it's very well possible. Here's a little fun fact. So Alcoholics Anonymous was started by this man named Bill Wilson, and Bill W. I mean, he's like the godfather of AA. You know, he was a wonderful man, had a lot of really great stuff, but he actually took LSD in a counselor's office back when it was still being prescribed for therapeutic reasons, chasing a spiritual experience, and he kept his sobriety date. So like way back when, that's how long this fight's been going on since back when LSD was still legal. And here we are still trying to find a way through it. But yeah. I think that there's a very real possibility for microdosing on psilocybin or LSD. I know that the Ibogaine is kind of like a, I've never done it. I've heard about the effects of it, and it seems like a very intense psychedelic trip that kind of resets your mind and body. And yeah, I don't know, man. I know that as far as mental health goes, we are still in the very infantile stages of understanding the mental health aspect of the human psyche. I mean, how long ago was it that we were doing lobotomies on people?
Right.
You know, yeah. Hell, they're still doing lobotomies with lithium.
Right.
You yeah. know, it's just chemical lobotomy. So we're still in the very, this is like the dark ages of mental health and understanding what that means. So I say, let the market do its thing, man. Quit throwing people in jail. And, you know, let's have a, let's let the market try to come up with some solutions for a change.
I totally, I mispronounced psilocybin. I said psilocybin. Wow.
Psilocybin.
Oh my God. You know, one thing that will give you humility is putting yourself out in front of a whole bunch of people and then saying something stupid or forgetting yeah. the next question.
I've been there.
In terms of that, I was going to say, I didn't know if you had any apprehension about treating a drug addiction with more substances, even if it's a different substance.
I actually had one of my mutuals on Twitter, he came on and he smokes weed, and by using marijuana, he's actually stayed sober from alcohol for over a year now, and it's worked out for him splendidly. So for me, I'm not that type of person. Like, I don't have that ability to, my mind, if something is triggering a pleasure receptor, mm-hmm. like I will continue to press that button over and over and over again. But for a lot of addicts and for people coming in the rooms, like I think that maybe there's a possibility that they could benefit from that. And here's the other thing. So like the old timers in 12-step rooms, they're very hard-nosed on this very topic. Hell, once upon a time, you could take aspirin and they'd be like, you need to change your clean date, man. You use, you know? So now we're getting to the point to where people with like 30 and 40 years clean are starting to get these terminal illnesses. And on their deathbed, they're freaking out because they're taking an OxyContin in a hospice. Mm-hmm. You know, and it shouldn't be that way. We shouldn't be having that type of perspective. I would much rather see a loved one take some edibles and have some relief that way, as opposed to being just completely zonked out on OxyContin or Opana or whatever, you know, opiate cocktail that the doctors are offering up personally. And you better believe that I'm abstinent now. Like, I don't use any mood changing or mind altering substances, but if I were to come down with a terminal illness and I was given a choice, I would absolutely go the route of, you know, marijuana or something to that effect. Now, to get kind of back to your point on treating addiction with another substance, we're already starting to see a lot of that with Subutex and Suboxone, which are opiate blockers. And, you know, that's kind of something that opiate addicts are using to wean off of heroin, you know, or pills or whatever the case may be. Now, if it's done right, I think it's great. But more often than not, what we see is these doctors that want to keep people on it. So that way they keep coming back and paying that doctor's fee and getting the kickback and all that. And I don't agree with that. I think that's taking advantage of addicts. But I would be interested to see some more studies done on marijuana for anxiety relief and whatnot, because I know that there's a lot of people who are dual diagnosed. Like, they have, you know, an addictive personality, but then they also have like chronic depression or anxiety, and being able to treat that with something besides like a Xanax or, you know, something hardcore like that. I would like to see that. And I would like to see a point to where we as a society welcomed people like that with open arms for making responsible decisions about their pathway forward in life.
Hang on a sec there, Drew. Hey, everybody, this is the portion of the show where I let you know how you can help support this content if you appreciate it. Non-monetary ways is subscribe, rate, review. All the links are libertyweekly.net/. So if you go to /iTunes, you can give me a rating and I'll read it on air in this portion of the show. Really do appreciate that. Monetary ways that you can support the show would be going to /Subscribestar. /Patreon or /float, FLOTE. And in that way, you can get Patreon bonuses like extras. You can join me for a Liberty Weekly podcast even, or for a B-side show at different levels. You can also get early access to content and other great perks. I'm actually going to start a series where you can join me and other listeners, other Patreon supporters, for a Zoom podcast that I'll be releasing on the Liberty Bigly podcast feed. But we'll all hang out together for about an hour. The first online hangout that I'm going to be doing will be occurring this coming Friday, and that will be February 5th at 8 p.m. Central Time, because I'm in Central Time. So if you'd like to support me at $5 a month on Patreon, Subscribestar, or $3 a month with crypto on float.app/FLOTE, you can join me this coming Friday at 8 p.m. and we'll hang out, have a great time, record it, and release the audio. So other ways you can support me is to subscribe primarily on library/LBRY. That's the new crypto YouTube. You can drop me LBC, or you can go to /Cointree and you can support me for crypto there and leave a message. Also, if you'd like to, I've been tearing it up on Substack lately, releasing a bunch of articles. So you can sign up there /Substack, Substack. Or if you want to join the Discord channel, it's /Discord. I'm also branching out into alternative social media sites like MeWe, Minds, and Hive. If you know what Hive is, join me there, subscribe, and upvote my content. If you don't know what Hive is, don't worry about it. But that'll be at /Hive, H-I-V-E. All right, well, those are all the ways that you can help support me. I really appreciate you listening. Hope you're enjoying the episode, and back to the show. Do you mind telling your story?
Not at all. So, and I started out just the same way as I always do, and that is, I was born the most awkward, weird, chubby kid that you can imagine, right? Like, I was the very poster child for social blunder. Like, I came out, dude, I just couldn't ever figure out where I was supposed to be and what I was supposed to be doing. And, you know, kind of the background is, my dad was a football jock. My mom was very, very popular in high school. So, you know, here they were, they got together, they had a son. They're like, oh, he's going to be these things. And he's like, not these things, you know? And so like, I tried, man, I really did. I remember trying soccer when I was a kid. Dad was into sports, so I wanted to be into sports. So I tried to be into soccer, but like running around a lot, just, that wasn't a good time, dude. I was a fat guy, you know? So, that wasn't going to work. I tried skateboarding, broke both of my wrists a lot.
Oh, geez. A lot?
A lot. Well, I still can't do an ollie, Pat. To this day, I still cannot do an ollie.
Who can, though?
I mean, wizards. That's right. Absolute wizards.
Tim Pool.
But, so... And there was one thing I was into, and it was Star Wars. I'm still into Star Wars. And so now we have the geek chic, right? We didn't used to have that back then.
Yeah.
It was, you were a nerd. It wasn't okay. So I remember when the Phantom Menace came out, there was this chain of stores that were around Oklahoma. It was called Hastings. And it was like, they sold comic books and CDs and things like that. Well, they said, you know, for the Phantom Menace premiere, you know, they were going to have this day of celebration at their store where if you dress up, you cosplay as your favorite Star Wars character, you show up, there's going to be other people who are there, and they're also going to be giving away door prizes. So I'm like, this is my chance, right? Like, I'm going to find my friends. And so I go to my mom and I'm like, Mom, will you buy me a Jedi outfit? And she's like, no. And so I'm like, damn it. So I had to look around, and You know, at Christmas time, when somebody buys you a cheap box of cologne, there's like a little weird gift that comes with it. Yeah. And I had some like knockoff cologne and this like knockoff cologne bathrobe. So I put this bathrobe on, right? And I get this cardboard or the wire hanger and I straighten it out and I put some cardboard on it and I paint it blue. And here I am, the most ghetto Luke Skywalker you've ever seen. And I'm like, Mom, take me to Hastings. My friends are waiting. Right. So we go up to Hastings and I'm the only person, the only one dressed up as anybody.
Oh, dude. No.
Yeah, it was bad. And the worst part of it is like they weren't even giving away stuff at the door. It was like 10% off coupons. So I was like, dude, this is a bust. So that's what Star Wars got me. So basically, just a whole lot of situations where I was always that guy who could just never get a leg up. Well, I started getting a lot of trouble at school, fighting and stuff like that. And my parents sent me to these doctors. And this was right in the height of the Johnny B. Goode meds, you know, Ritalin and Adderall and Vyvanse was getting thrown around like candy. And I actually got put on one called Dexedrine. And Dexedrine is like straight up meth, like straight up. It's not too far off from the real deal. And I will never forget taking this pill and feeling like a eureka moment. Like, oh my God, this is what's been missing my whole life. This is what I need to feel okay. And, you know, I kind of behavioral wise, I did kind of good, but then also started doing way worse. And long story short, I kept messing up. When I hit 18, I hit the streets and I started chasing that initial high, you know, that I was after. And man, I tried every single thing underneath the sun and I had some really high highs and some really low lows. And throughout it all, like I had several relationships that would come and go. You know, I called them relationships. You would probably call them hostage situations. You know, we just kind of held a gun to each other's heads and sucked the life out of each other. But, and one of these relationships, she got pregnant and, we had a little girl and I will never forget the day that my daughter was born and I held her in my arms and see, I had made many attempts in my lifetime to do the right thing, to set my life on a positive trajectory. And I always came up short, but I looked at this kid and I'm like, you know what? Every single thing that I had inside of me to be a better person was passed on to her. And I was like, you know what? I finally have a reason to get clean. So I'm like, I'm done. I'm not using anymore. Fast forward a year and a half, we're in the dope house. My daughter walks in and she's holding one of my needles in her hand. You know, that's what my willpower did. And the most beautiful, wonderful, bright spot in my life, holding the most shameful thing in my life. And it was like a true crossroads for me. And I think it was like 2 days later, my mom showed up. I don't know how she found us, but she did. And she had paperwork from a judge for temporary legal guardianship. And living the lifestyle that I lived, like I was like, you know what? I knew this day was going to come. And I always like told myself, like, I'm going to fight her on this. You're not taking my daughter. But man, after that, after what just happened, I was like, I had no fight left in me. I was like, you know what? Take her. And she said, Drew, I can't stop you from ruining your life, but I can stop you from ruining hers. And I'll never forget coming back inside from the parking lot. And everybody in that dope house is like, dude, you're an idiot because addicts like us don't get clean. You're never going to see her again. That's it. And I believe them, man. Fast forward some couple years. I'm in and out of dope houses. And then all of a sudden, like the dope dealer won't sell me dope. They're telling me to go to detox. when your dope dealer's like, hey man, you might need to get some help. I think it's time to listen. And so, And so I went and got some help. And, you know, sometimes I stuck around for a couple weeks, sometimes I didn't. But that last time, I was really desperate. I had nowhere to go. I was walking around, and it was like the morning commute, right? It was during the middle of the work week. And I'm walking down the street at like 7:30 in the morning, and I see all these cars driving to work, driving to take their kids to school. All of them were doing something. And the thought dawned on me. It's like, these people have purpose, you know? And like, I don't have purpose, but these people have purpose. And I think that was kind of like the beginning of the aha moment for me that pulled me out of the crazy. And, having spent some time in the detoxes and stuff, I had a couple of numbers on my phone, and I called one, and this guy said, you know what? I moved way out of town, but you're in luck. There's some people locally that are coming to visit me. You can catch a ride with them. And so I got out of town and I went and met up with this guy, and he spoon fed me. He let me stay on his couch, and he spoon fed me the very basic concepts of recovery from a perspective that I could understand. So I can't tell you how many countless judges, how many police officers, how many counselors, priests, I mean, every authority figure that you can imagine had tried to tell me these very things that this man was telling me, and I couldn't hear it. But since he had done that, it's like, I don't know, man. It's like I received that information from him, and it made sense to me. And so I my hard-headed, stubborn self became open to the idea of taking some direction from somebody that wasn't me. And so I started to, you know, do what he said. And little by little, my life got better. I mean, I had like an outstanding warrant. I went and sat in jail for 4 months for that. Dude, and going to jail sober sucks. That's the first time I'd ever been.
And you were in county, right?
Yeah. Usually when I go to county, I get like 4 or 5 days of sleeping, and then I wake up, and then it dawns on me. I'm like, oh, this sucks. But no, it was like out the gate in the receiving area. Like, oh, dude, it sucked. But, you know, I did it. And I did it because this goofball who lived way out of town had been there and done it, and he taught me how to get my stuff together, and it worked. Trying to compress it as much as I can.
Don't worry about that. I want everything.
Okay. But like I got out, and like, here's the thing. My whole life had revolved around the getting and using and finding ways and means to get more. The literature that I refer to, and, you know, in recovery, it talks about we use to live and live to use. And so I had to learn how to have hygiene. I had to learn how to wash my clothes. I had to be taught at the age of 25 how to do these very basic things, 'cause I didn't know.
Yeah.
I had no idea. And so it's like, they talk about, if you use, like, from the point you started using to the point you got clean, like, you did not mature in there at all, right? So, like, yeah, I was 25, but I was still 18. Like, I didn't know. Like, I had no concept of what it meant to have a 401k or mortgage and all this scary stuff that adults would talk about. You know, when I say adults, I'm talking about, like, people 3 years younger than me at the time, you know? Right. Like, I didn't get it. And so the benefit of being involved in recovering, having those numbers, is that I got to hang out with these people. And see, I was really scared to ask people how to do these things properly. I had to watch them, because I learned a long time ago that talk is cheap, because I ran my word into the ground, but your actions spoke to me in a very real way. And so I would sit back and watch how people conducted themselves, even to the extent of how they dealt with, like, retail, you know, like if we're out to eat, how they dealt with the waitress. Like, that's how I learned how to be socially acceptable, you know, but yeah. It's little things like that. And, slowly but surely, man, I got my life back on track, and that little girl came back into my life, and I went from being homeless and sleeping in a tent behind a Walmart to now, like, I own my own house. Like, I bought this home. I'm a truck driver today. Not a glamorous job by any stretch of the imagination, but it pays the bills.
I was going to ask you if you could get a CDL with a felony.
I can. Yeah. I still am uncertain whether or not, because there's, so you get a CDL, right? And then there's different endorsements you can get to add on.
Yeah. Yep.
And one of them is a hazmat. And I know that, like, in order to get a hazmat, you got to get a background check. And so I don't know if my felony would bar me from that or not. So I've been fortunate enough to not need that endorsement, but I have been able to make a decent living for myself with the CDL.
Do you come home every night, or are you a long haul?
Yeah, I'm home every night. I drive a concrete mixer. So nice. Like I run mud here at home, and then when we're done, we're done. I go home and take a bath and do it again the next day.
Good for you, brother. That is so inspiring. Have you seen Intervention?
Yes.
Does it pain you to watch that, or can you watch it? Do you, like, get inspired by some of the stories where they get clean, or?
Here's the thing. I don't watch that because it's like, it hurts to see that, because I identify a lot. There was a man, when I talked about going to meetings and trying to get clean, like, dude, when you go to AA, whenever you show up for your first meeting, they give you a 24-hour coin. I got enough of those 24-hour coins that I could tile a bathroom floor. Like,
yeah,
dude, I could not stay clean. I could not. I struggled for a very, very long time with that. So I was that person who just couldn't get it. And just the thought of, like, that being on television, like, dude, it sucks. That sucks really bad.
I know, like, the Intervention, like, the show itself has gotten a lot of awards, but I know that people in the recovery community have had criticized it for their certain tactics they've used. Do you have any opinion on that? Just curious.
Yeah, dude, that's because you're putting somebody on blast. So it not only is it bad enough that they have to carry the criminal record around with them, but now there is a permanent videographed record of who they were. Their darkest
moment, yeah.
Yeah, and so it's like a Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde situation. And while I know that, somebody else may not know that. And so, you know, I can only imagine the type of societal pressure that has to have on somebody's psyche, just knowing that when they meet somebody new, whether they're clean or not, oh my God, do they know me as who I am now, or do they know me of who I was?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
I think about the air duster lady.
Oh, Jesus.
You know, and she's turned into such a lovely, wonderful looking person, but all anyone is going to remember is I'm walking on sunshine, you know?
Yeah, man. Yeah.
Partly because of South Park, which I love South Park, but
yeah.
Yeah. So, wow. That's just an incredible story. And do you ever feel like are you someone who believes that things happen for a reason?
Yeah, I think that you know, to a degree, yeah, you know, there's some stuff that I hear around the rooms that I don't agree with. Like, I hear about, oh, some addicts have to die so that others may live. And that is just bullshit. I don't think any addict needs to die in order for me to find recovery. I think that we are able to find recovery without that negative doomsday stuff over our head. Like, back when I was using, man, a very close friend of me overdosed and died in my arms. And that kid did not need to die. Joe did not need to die that day in order for me to find recovery. God knows I didn't find recovery after that. That worsened it, you know? Yeah, I don't know, man.
Wow, that's an interesting dark spot.
I'm sorry.
I'm sorry, because I mean, I guess at least in my life, you know, I've dealt with some adversity, probably nothing like you have. You know, it's like apples and oranges in a way. You know, for me, when I look at the pattern of my life, I can always pinpoint something bad happening to me and saying, you know, oh, well, that bad thing happened, but it turned into that, you know, or something like that. That's not true for everybody, you know?
No. And we talk about that in recovery. You know, there's a certain breed of person who can have a jarring experience, be it they got arrested with a substantial amount of Tim Allen. You know, we all know that guy. You know, that dude made a huge name for himself. Well, he got busted with God knows how many kilos of coke, you know, like that was his moment for him. Now he's a snitch. And anyway, we can get off into that, but whatever. But anyway, there's Tim Allen's, and then there's people like the Clean Libertarian here who, like, dude, it took a culmination, a lot of those really dark moments, in order for me to remember. Like, that's the problem that I no longer am faced with the problem of thinking, oh, it'll be different this time. I am faced with the problem of getting to such a place to where I just don't care, that I will go forward knowing full well the results anyway. And so that's kind of like that spot that I'm in, as opposed to somebody else who was able to kind of get scared straight. And I know that's a lame way to put it, but it's, you know, what it is.
Yeah. Another thing. Do you believe that addiction is a disease?
Here's the thing is that, like, I'm not a medical professional, but I've always thought the word disease was kind of a victimized label. I think it's more adequately described as an illness, and that's coming from a commercial truck driver. So take that with a grain of salt.
I suppose there's a very different connotation between disease and illness. You know,
if it is a disease, it's the only disease that will convince the host that it doesn't have it. It's the only disease on the face of the earth that will convince the person who has the disease that they actually don't have it, you know? And that's the problem that we face is having to come to terms with the fact that, dude, look, I am an addict or I am an alcoholic. I cannot partake in these things. Like, that for me especially was a very long, long road to get to that place of acceptance. So, yeah.
I dated someone in college, in undergrad, whose brother was, first of all, he was a vet, an Iraq war vet. And yeah, it was actually his story. He was an addict before he became a vet. And I never knew him when he was an addict, but he could chug vodka, you know, and heroin was his drug of choice too. And I never knew him during that time, but just the craziest stories, man. Just,
yeah, man,
the craziest. I can't even imagine.
Yeah, some people, but, like, you know, like I said, some people are able to grow out of it to a certain degree, you know, and stop. Hell, I've known people who could buy like an 8-ball of coke and make that last them a month.
Yeah.
Like, dude, I just couldn't understand it. They would put, like, you know, they would take a little bit of it out and, like, okay, this is what we're doing tonight. And they put the rest of it in their closet. And, like, for me, like, I would just constantly be thinking about what's in the closet, right? Like, you know, but I don't know. I never grew out of it, I guess.
Yeah. Is it something that you can grow out of?
I think for some people it is. I think some people, they're young and they're wild, you know, and they're doing their thing and they actually do grow out of it, you know? And for others, it's just not the case. And it's such a dangerous journey trying to figure out which one that you are, you know, because here's the thing. I've sponsored guys in the rooms who came in and they got caught with a little bit of heroin. And, you know, they weren't necessarily addicts. Like, they weren't, you know, and, like, I can't tell them that because, you know, like, that's something that you have to determine on your own. Now, there's some questions that I can ask that can maybe help you find the answer to that. But there is no one solution for everybody. And it's such a nuanced discussion. And like I said, we're still on the very beginning stages of understanding not only what addiction is, but how it starts. That, you know, it's hard to nail that down. So maybe growing out of it isn't the right word, but that's the only thing that I know to say. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Have you found it fulfilling to be a sponsor?
At times. Here's the thing is that, like, so recovery works because you're essentially learning how to be a productive human being, and not just a great value productive human being, but like top shelf productive human being. You're learning how to own up for your own actions. You're learning how to have a decorum going forward in life that people like look up to. And watching that aha moment happen for other people is just, dude, it's a beautiful thing. But the tough part is whenever you're sponsoring somebody, they're doing so good, and then they go back out, and then you hear, you know, about how they died, you know, some months later. Like, that sucks.
Yeah,
that's no fun, you know. But I still won't stop. I won't stop sponsoring people. I won't stop working with other people because nobody gave up on me.
Yeah, is that part of the journey? Is that if you have so many years of sobriety, are you expected to sponsor someone, or is that just what most people do?
That if you're attending a 12-step fellowship and you're working the steps, you are expected to give that back what was freely given to you. Like, then that's kind of how it works, right? Like, it stops being about, like, because my family still doesn't understand it. Like, they're like, why do you keep going to those meetings? And it's not because I need the meetings for me. It's because I have to learn how to give. I have to continue giving what was given to me back to other people. You know, and this whole pandemic thing, dude, it screwed up meetings across the country. Yeah. But in the heyday, you know, before all this crap hit, like, that's how it was, man. You showed up, you made the coffee, and you sat there and you waited for that new guy to crawl through the threshold of that door because they didn't have anywhere else to go. And you're like, that's why I showed up tonight, is for him.
Yeah.
You know, and that's kind of how it works.
How old is your daughter now?
My daughter is 11 years old now.
Yeah. Awesome.
Yeah, dude. It's awesome, man. It's great. You know, now she's starting to, like, she's into video games. So, like, the nerdy dad is like, cool. Here, dude. And I got the 3D printer. And so, you know, the blocks that, you know, Mario and Mario, the blocks with the question mark on it.
Yeah, yeah.
So I figured out how to, like, 3D print one of those blocks, and it has Nintendo Switch cartridge holders in it. And so I was able to, dude, it's just, I'm nerding out over here so hard. If I could just get her to like Star Wars, I'll be golden, but we're not there yet.
See, with my son, it's, he just turned 20 months, and,
oh man, that's awesome.
Oh yeah. He's running around, we wrestle, and, you know, we play and we do all that kind of stuff. And he's on the threshold of talking.
Yeah.
I can't wait for him to be able to talk, and I can't wait to be able to, I want to read The Hobbit to my kids, because yeah, my thing is Lord of the Rings. I also like, I was into Stargate, you know,
okay.
Not, I don't know if you ever got into that, but I've been getting into Star Trek too. Star Wars never did it for me, although I really liked Rogue One. I don't know if you,
dude, how could you not?
Yeah.
How could you not?
I thought it was
just a masterpiece.
I thought it was great. I really,
yeah.
I mean, in the darkness of it, it was,
yes,
it was gritty and real. I felt like,
yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, well, that's just, I'm so glad that you've been able to, you know, get your daughter back and provide a home for her. And like, that's awesome. What would you say to anyone out there who listens to the show, who's struggling with addiction?
take it from a chronic retread like myself. This is something that somebody told me, and it really turned the lights on for me. And that is, it's all one big try. That's all it is, man. Yesterday don't matter. Tomorrow ain't here yet. Today, all you got your try. So let that try take you into the rooms. I don't know if you do show notes or not, but if you want, you guys can find me on, he'll have the links for my Twitter handle, and I keep my DMs open, even if we aren't following each other, and you're more than welcome to contact me. Hell, make a sock account. I'll still reply to it and we can talk about it, man. But just for today, if you stay clean from the time you hear this, I promise that I will go to bed clean right there with you. So you don't have to do it alone. And then tomorrow morning we can reevaluate and take it from there.
Yeah. Yeah. That's awesome. And it's just like with everything happening, things seem like they were like pretty tough and bad before COVID hit. And then now with everything, it's just like, I can't imagine the effects that this is going to have and continue to have and just reverberate. You mentioned just briefly that it's disrupted all the 12-step meetings, but have you anecdotally seen the effect of it, that people are relapsing?
Yeah, I actually went out of town. Like I live in Oklahoma City. We went to Indiana for my wife's family, and I went to a meeting out there, and they said that they have lost about 40% of their core members to relapse as a result of the lockdowns. Wow. And like that, at that point, things were starting to kind of be lifted a little bit. And I'm sure now they've ramped back up and they're all shut down again. But it's just like, you're taking away people's lifeline, and it's not fair and it's not right and it's not okay.
Yeah.
Blood is on the hands of these people making these decisions. And I don't know if I could find good words to say about them anytime in the near future. But
what can you do? I get, and the COVID thing is a whole nother can of worms. It's like,
that is,
yeah.
Like right now what we're seeing is a lot of Zoom meetings, which Zoom is cool, but we got to deal with what we can. And so we have Zoom meetings available, and one day we're going to make it through this, and it's going to be different, and we're going to be able to meet up in person again. But until that day comes, we got to, like I said, work with what we got. And so we got Zoom meetings, and if anybody needs some information on that, you can always reach out to me. And, hell, if you ever know personally anybody, how to get a hold of me.
Yeah.
I'd be more than happy to hook them up.
Yeah, for sure. Do you find that the recovery community generally is more COVID, a COVID evangelical? I have this clever term for someone who believes in who is COVIDian. Definitely a COVIDian. There was some like the I had something better than COVIDian. I like COVIDian though.
The branch COVIDians. It's weird, man. Every group has its own little flair. Every group has its own little feeling and theme. And some groups are a lot more hardcore, and then some are like really scared and they won't meet up, and they shut down the meeting halls. And it's literally on a clubhouse by clubhouse basis.
Yeah.
It's so different, I mean, just like in the political sphere, you got so many different mentalities and ideas. Recovery is no different. You got a lot of people who look at things different ways.
Yeah. So. And like, I don't mean to be an asshole or anything, but it seems like people who would take a risk with different drugs, why would they be worried about getting together with people?
Dude, preach it to the choir, brother. Yeah. I said the same thing. I told him there is zero chance that COVID would have scared me from the dope house back when. Like, dude, I shot up with rainwater from a gutter, on the bottom of a Coke can I found in the dumpster. Like, COVID ain't scaring me.
Right.
I told people, like, I got Keith Richards' spirit animal inside of me. Like, I ain't dying anytime soon. COVID ain't taking me out.
Yeah, man. Yeah, well, what an experience, man. I'm so glad to get you on the show and talk about this. Like, One thing I talked to Scott Spaulding, who was he was an Iraq and Afghanistan war vet, and then I talked to Carmen Alexi about her experience fleeing communist Romania. And ever since I talked to them, I've had this desire for my show to talk to people with very interesting and challenging life experiences. And because these conversations are just so enriching for me personally on a very selfish level. But
well, that's a two-way street, man. I love the content that you put out. Like I said, man, yeah. I wouldn't be where I am today if you guys didn't continue plugging away. So thank you for doing what you do.
Yeah, well, I appreciate it, man. And we had talked your last episode, I would point all the listeners to, because that was a really fun conversation. So I'll put it in the show notes page, so check it out.
Yeah, do that. But, appreciate that.
Yeah, well, do you want to, I guess we got about like 5 minutes here or whatever. Do you want to talk about what you've covered on your show and plug your show?
Yeah, we've got several different things. I've had one of the things that we're working on currently is trying to get a caucus started within the Libertarian Party, and, you know, love them or hate them, if you're an addict in recovery or just a teetotaler and you want somewhere to go when you're at a convention and not have to worry about it, the Straight Edge Caucus is being formulated. I had Kim Ruff on. We were able to talk about that, and she's kind of helping me moderate over at Facebook. She's got the page over there. I'm handling the Twitter one. So that was a recent episode. Another one that we've done, like the one you pointed out, was with Evan. Evan's a character, man, and he's kind of laid out like some of the prepper, you know, terms. Yeah. And like trying to understand like what does a bug out bag need to consist of. And one of the things that I like to talk about is kind of like agorism and learning how to be self-sufficient. And so I've got an episode coming up within the next couple of weeks where a friend of mine is going to be talking to us about how to get your garden ready for the next upcoming season, soil fertility and all of that. And so I try to cover some of the bases and things not pertaining to the drug war. But like I said, I think I kind of painted myself in the corner a little bit, but we're going to make the best out of it, Pat.
Well, you can rebrand, and you know, what is clean living could be, you know, gardening or,
it's therapeutic, man. I'll tell you that much right now. Like last year was my first year doing a garden, and my wife thought it would be a perfect time to get a puppy. And so you put those two together, and I didn't have a successful garden last year. Yeah. That's the long of it.
I don't know if I was talking to you about it, if we were talking in DMs about gardening, or I tried last summer, and the carrots went good. The potatoes went good. That was about it. I couldn't get the onions to grow very much. They were like this big, and the strawberries, I didn't put like a fence up, and they just got eaten up. And the tomatoes didn't take either, because I put them in their own pots, and it's like you can't. I've heard you can't do that. You have to have them in free soil.
Actually, you can put them in pots, but put marigold dandelions in there.
Yeah.
Am I saying that right? Dandelion? It's a little, dandelions.
Yeah,
dandelions. Like, what they do is because like when tomatoes, and I learned this last year too, tomatoes, I hate tomatoes, and that's the only damn thing that would grow.
Really?
Yes.
So you have the opposite problem.
Dude, I hate them.
I love spaghetti. Spaghetti is by far my favorite thing to eat. So I wanted to make my own salsa and spaghetti sauce.
Well, there you go. For in this next year, get you some marigolds and plant them inside the same planter, because I guess that it helps with root production for the tomato plant.
Really?
Whatever. Yeah. Try them out.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Well, and I'm going to have to listen to your gardening episode too.
Yes.
Because now is the perfect timing to, I guess, as it probably doesn't get as cold in Oklahoma as it does up here, but
no.
Perfect timing to what's the temperature there, right? Do you know?
Like right now, I think it's like 40 outside, but here's the thing. So it could be 27 degrees tomorrow morning and then be like 70 tomorrow afternoon.
What? Like 70?
Yes. Yes. I swear to God, Oklahoma is bipolar. Like it's hard. A lot of these things that, you know, they say, wait until the last frost. It's like, That could be
anytime.
Yeah. We don't know.
People say this about Wisconsin, but they're like, well, in Wisconsin, you could get like 7 different weather patterns in one day.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like that's just something everyone says everywhere, though.
It might be. That may be the case. I always thought Oklahoma was unique in that, but I guess not.
See, yeah, everyone has these things that they say that's unique to their area, but they're like, you get totally to talking and it's like, no, we have that too.
I bet probably like Arizona, New Mexico would be more stable and their, you know, climate patterns. But yeah, maybe Midwest is just, we're plagued with it.
Yeah.
It could go either way.
Yeah, it could be. Yeah. Well, Drew, I don't want to keep you. I know you got a big interview coming up here with Josh Smith, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Awesome. Yeah. I'm not dropping this until next week. So, but one last plug. Is there a website you want to send people?
No website. Just okay. I don't do Facebook. I don't like Zuckerberg. I'm sure he doesn't like me either. So on Twitter, it's @clean_podcast, or my main account is @libertydrew84.
Okay.
And so Clean Libertarian Podcast is available on all the podcatchers. And yeah, check me out, man. Give it a like, a listen, and a rating if you can.
All right. Awesome. Well, thanks for joining us. I'm sure we'll talk again soon.
I hope so, man. This was great. Thanks, Pat.